Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Chris Kresser. Chris Kresser is the CEO of Kresser Institute, the co-director of the California Center for Functional Medicine, the creator of ChrisKresser.com, and the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Cure and Unconventional Medicine. He is known for his in-depth research uncovering myths and misconceptions in modern medicine and providing natural health solutions with proven results. Chris was named one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness by Greatest.com, and his blog is one of the top-ranked natural health websites in the world. He has trained over 400 clinicians and 300 health coaches through his ADAPT programs, which incorporate functional medicine, ancestral diet, and lifestyle and behavioral change. Chris?
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, and welcome. Good to see everybody here. So tonight we're going to talk about the future of medicine. And I'm going to make three arguments in this presentation. So number one is that chronic disease is the biggest challenge we face by far from a healthcare perspective. A little slide glitch there. Number two is that the consequences of chronic disease are really severe, not only for patients, but also for healthcare providers and for society at large. And number three, we desperately need a new paradigm of healthcare, one that is better equipped to prevent and reverse chronic disease, to offer a higher level of care for patients, to offer more meaningful and rewarding work for healthcare providers, and a more economically sustainable model for governments. So let's start by talking a little bit more about chronic disease. One in two Americans now suffers from chronic disease, and one in four suffer from multiple chronic diseases. Chronic disease is now responsible for 7 of 10 deaths, and it's not just affecting adults. 27% of kids now have a chronic disease, and that's up from just 13% in 2006. So a doubling in just the last 12 years alone. And this is particularly notable in kids for obesity, asthma, and learning disorders. The economic implications of this are simply staggering. It's estimated that expenditures on chronic disease will reach almost $50 trillion by the year 2030. Now, this is an almost inconceivable number, really. But to put it in perspective, it's more than the GDP of the 6 largest economies in the world. Now, chronic disease has become so common that we think it's normal. I'm going to see if I can... I think the pointer is causing some problems, so let's see if we can do this. So chronic disease has been so common that we think it's normal, but there's a really big difference between what is common and what's normal. Contrary to popular belief, it's not normal for humans to develop chronic disease. We are naturally healthy and vital when we live in alignment with our genes and our biology. And this is true both in our younger life and as we age. And I'll give you some examples of this. The Simane are a hunter-gatherer and horticulturalist society in Bolivia. So they do some subsistence farming. They hunt and they gather. They eat primarily meat, fish, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and some starchy plants like plantains. They walk an average of 17,000 steps a day, which is about 8 miles. And they spend a lot of time outdoors. They get plenty of sleep. They aren't exposed to a lot of artificial light at night. Now, some researchers went down to study them because they were curious about, you know, how their rates of heart disease compared with ours in the industrialized world. And they found that the Simane had a prevalence of atherosclerosis that is 80% lower than ours in the U.S. They found that nearly 9 in 10 Simane adults between the ages of 40 and 94 years old had completely clean arteries on a CT scan, so virtually no risk of heart disease. Now, a lot of people have argued that hunter-gatherers don't acquire chronic diseases because they don't live long enough to acquire them. But as this study showed, there were adults up to 94 years of age, and the researchers actually found that the average Simane who was 80 years old had the same vascular age as an American in his or her mid-50s. So clearly what we're doing in the industrialized world isn't working, but why? So I would say there are three key reasons. Number one is that there's a fundamental mismatch between our genes and our biology and the modern environment that we're living in today. Number two is that our medical paradigm is not well suited to tackle chronic disease. And number three is that our care model, our healthcare model, doesn't support the interventions that would make the biggest impact on reducing chronic disease. So let's talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. So the evolutionary biologist Theodosius Dobzhansky once said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." So what did he mean by this? All organisms, including human beings, are adapted to survive and thrive in a particular environment. And when that environment changes faster than our genes can adapt, a mismatch occurs. And this is a fundamental principle in evolutionary biology, and it applies to human beings as much as it applies to any other organism in nature. For 66,000 generations, or a little over 2 million years, humans ate primarily meat, fish, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and some starchy plants, just like the Simane diet that they're still eating now. We were physically active. We didn't sit for long periods. We lived in direct contact with nature in close-knit tribal social groups. Now, both our hunter-gatherer ancestors and contemporary hunter-gatherers were remarkably lean and fit and virtually free of chronic inflammatory disease. They were also superior to us in nearly every measure of health and fitness, from body mass index to blood pressure to insulin sensitivity to oxygen consumption to vision to bone density. Now again, some people have said, well, so what? Even if our hunter-gatherer ancestors were healthier than we were when they were young, they all died when they were 30. Well, it turns out this is a myth. It is true that our hunter-gatherer ancestors and contemporary hunter-gatherers have shorter lifespans than we do on average, but those averages don't consider very high rates of infant mortality due to a complete lack of emergency medical care. Anthropologists who've studied hunter-gatherer populations have found that if they survive childhood and if they have access to even the most rudimentary forms of emergency medical care, like walking for half a day to get through a rural medical clinic, they live lifespans that are equivalent to our own. But the difference is they reach the older ages without acquiring all of the chronic inflammatory diseases that characterize our old age. They don't tend to get cardiovascular disease. They don't tend to get diabetes. They don't tend to get Alzheimer's. They don't tend to get most forms of cancer. So the Simane are a really good example of this, but there are several other extant hunter-gatherer populations that have been studied in the 20th century and more recently, and these include the Kitavans and the Tukasenta in the South Pacific, the Maasai tribe in East Africa, and then the Hadza and the Kungsan also in Africa. So the question is, where did we go wrong? What happened? What transformed us from a healthy, vital people? That pretty much sums it up, right? What transformed us from a healthy, vital people that was largely free of inflammatory and chronic disease to a sick, fat, and unhealthy people? Well, it wasn't our genes. It was the mismatch between our genes and our modern environment. And this mismatch is the primary driver of the chronic disease epidemic that we're facing today. Another way to think of it is as an unnatural slow motion plague that is killing us by the millions each year and destroying our quality of life. Now, at one time, it seemed that our genes would hold the answer to solving chronic disease. Who here is old enough to remember the human genome being sequenced and all the enthusiasm and excitement that went with that and claims like, you know, this was going to be the end of chronic disease. We've now finally solved the puzzle and we don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, it didn't really turn out that way, did it? We now know that the environment and particularly how the environment affects gene expression is the primary driver of chronic disease. And in fact, recent studies have shown that 85% at least of the risk of chronic disease is due to environmental factors that are modifiable, not our genes. The second problem is that our medical paradigm is not effective for addressing chronic disease. Now, our medical paradigm has been incredible for acute problems, the development of antibiotics, the recognition that we needed a sterile operating environment, vaccines have led to incredible improvements in our health, extension of lifespan. You know, humans are living longer lifespan than ever before now. And, you know, if I get hit by a bus, I definitely want to be taken to the hospital. We're starting to be able to reattach limbs. We're restoring sight to people who are blind. We might be fighting cancer with nanorobots in our lifetime. Conventional medicine has some amazing things to offer, particularly at the far end of that spectrum. But if we imagine health on a spectrum where on the left is perfect health and on the right is death, I think we can all agree that conventional medicine really excels at intervening on the far right end of that spectrum and is not really set up to promote health and address chronic disease, which, as we have established, is the biggest challenge that we're facing from a healthcare perspective today. So one reason for this is that there's been a dramatic change in the healthcare landscape over the past 100 years. So the top three causes of death back in 1900 were all acute infectious diseases, typhoid, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. Other major reasons that people saw the doctor at that time also were acute. So a broken bone or an appendicitis or an injury that they had in the workplace. Now, the treatment for these conditions was relatively simple. It wasn't always effective, but it was relatively simple. So, for example, the doctor would set the bone in the cast, or the surgeon would remove the appendix. Later, once antibiotics were developed, they would prescribe an antibiotic for the infection. So there was one problem, one doctor, and one treatment. Now, you fast forward to today, the top three causes of death are cardiovascular disease, cancer, and lung disease. These are all, of course, chronic conditions. And chronic conditions, unlike acute problems, are difficult to manage, they're expensive to treat, and they often last for a lifetime. So they don't lend themselves well to this one doctor, one disease, one treatment approach that worked well for those acute problems in the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century. Today's patient, in fact, has multiple diseases. They see multiple doctors. And in fact, sometimes a different doctor for every different part of the body, right? And then they require multiple treatments over the course of their entire lifetime. Another reason the conventional model hasn't been successful is that it emphasizes suppressing symptoms rather than addressing the underlying cause of the problem. Now, an example of this would be if you go into the doctor and you have high blood pressure, what's going to happen? You're given a drug to lower your blood pressure. If you have high cholesterol, what's going to happen? Given a drug to lower it. How long will you be advised to take these drugs? Exactly. So this is the situation in a nutshell. We have a conventional system that is approaching chronic disease like, you know, putting a Band-Aid on it, lowering the numbers, using drugs to suppress symptoms, But the problem is there's rarely any investigation into why the blood pressure is high in the first place, or why the cholesterol is high in the first place. And the same is true for many other chronic conditions like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, depression, autoimmune disease, hypothyroidism, etc. So let's talk a little bit about IBS as an example here. So IBS is now an epidemic. It's the second leading cause of people missing work behind the common cold. And the treatments for IBS are all based around symptom suppression. So if the patient has diarrhea, they'll be prescribed Imodium. If they have constipation, they'll be prescribed a motility drug. If they have pain, they'll be prescribed an analgesic, a pain reliever. They will sometimes be prescribed antidepressants to help with the nervous system aspect of the condition. Now, don't get me wrong, these drugs can be helpful and, you know, they can provide relief to the patient, which is very welcome because it can be a really debilitating condition. But again, the problem is that none of those treatments actually address the root causes of IBS. And it's not like we don't know what they are. You can look in PubMed and scientific literature and find thousands of papers linking problems like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO to IBS, undetected parasite infections, fungal overgrowth, disrupted gut microbiome, gut-brain axis issues. They're all plenty of papers that establish these links, but we're not looking for them in the typical approach to IBS. And this means that the patient will end up on often a handful of medications that they need to take for the rest of their life. And oftentimes, one of those medications will cause a side effect. And what's the solution for that typically? Another medication. So you get to this situation where by the time someone is in their 60s or 70s, they're often taking five or more medications. So finally, the third reason that conventional medicine has failed to address chronic disease is that the model for delivering care doesn't support the interventions that would make the biggest impact on reducing chronic disease. So the number one cause of chronic disease, as I've argued, is not genetic. We could even say that it's not environmental. It's behavioral. People making the wrong choices about what to eat and physical activity, sleep, stress management on a daily basis. Now, certainly our modern environment strongly impacts our behavior. So I'm not suggesting that those are separate. But the problem is most individuals don't have full control over the modern environment. We might have some limited control over our own environment, but we have to learn to work with the environment that we're a part of. So we could argue that changing our behavior is the single most important step we can take to prevent and reverse chronic disease. But conventional medicine is not set up to support patients in making behavior change. Does anyone know how long the average visit with a primary care provider is today? That's right. Anywhere between 8 and 12 minutes, depending on what study you look at. New doctors coming out of medical school now, it's closer to 8 minutes, or residents, and you know, the average across the U.S. is 10 to 12 minutes. So can we all agree that it's impossible to deliver high-quality care in a 10 to 12-minute visit when a patient is showing up with at least one chronic disease and sometimes four chronic diseases? They might be taking multiple medications. It's barely enough time to say hello, collect the chief complaints, and write another prescription. There's no time to dig into the important diet, lifestyle, and behavior changes that would be necessary to reverse their condition and prevent new conditions from developing. And the average primary care provider, do you know how many patients they have on their panel? 2,500 patients. So it's virtually impossible for them to develop meaningful relationships that would support those kinds of changes. And it's not their fault. The vast majority of primary care providers I know are doing their best to help their patients, and they went into medicine for the right reasons. They're just as much victims of the conventional system as patients are. Even if a healthcare provider does make a suggestion in the context of this 10 to 12 minute appointment, like suggest a healthier diet, will that suggestion be helpful? We now know that knowledge is not enough to change behavior in the vast majority of cases. How many people know they should be doing something but aren't doing it? Show of hands. I think it's pretty safe to say everyone in this room, including me. Yet the conventional system is still based in this expert approach, where the idea is that the expert, the doctor, will deliver the information to the patient, and the patient will say, "Thank you, doctor," and go and put it into practice. How often does that work? Less than 6% of the time, we know, actually, from statistics. So the CDC has published data showing that that about 6% of Americans, only 6% of Americans engage in the top 5 health behaviors. And it's not because they don't know what they are. All right, so far we've established that chronic disease is the biggest challenge we face, and that the conventional medicine has not only failed to address it, but it has really little chance of success addressing it, at least in its current configuration, without some pretty big systemic changes. Now let's look a little more closely at the consequences, not only for patients, but also for healthcare providers and for society at large. So the consequences for consumers are painfully obvious. There's been a dramatic increase in chronic disease. 1 billion people around the world now suffer from diabetes and obesity. 40% of Americans are obese now, according to the latest CDC statistics. And 100 million Americans have either diabetes or prediabetes. That's 1 in 3 Americans with either diabetes or prediabetes. And as I said before, this problem is not just affecting adults. Obesity has quadrupled in the adolescent population in the past 30 years alone. And almost 20% of kids between the ages of 6 and 11 years old are now obese. Some estimates suggest that up to 1 in 6 Americans now have an autoimmune disease, and those numbers are climbing each year. According to the CDC, autism prevalence has more than doubled since the year 2000, and it's not just because of increased rates of detection. The number of people who are diagnosed with depression is expected to increase by 20% year over year, according to the World Health Organization. Over half of adults now take prescription drugs. 40% of the elderly take more than 5 medication. That's that drug treadmill that I talked about earlier. 90% take over-the-counter drugs. Unfortunately, the problem is likely going to get worse before it gets better. You may have heard this. I was pretty devastated when I heard it. Today is the first generation of kids since we've been measuring that's expected to live shorter lifespans than us, their parents. And as a parent myself, that's pretty heartbreaking. The rise of chronic disease has a huge impact on patients. On a personal level, it erodes quality of life, it interferes with relationships and work, and it undermines our confidence and our autonomy. But there's also a tremendous economic cost to individuals. Medical expenses are the number one cause of bankruptcy, far ahead of student debt and credit card debt. But it's not just patients that are affected, it's also clinicians. According to a recent survey by the Physicians Foundation, 90% of physician surveys felt that medicine is on the wrong track. 85% feel the physician-patient relationship is deteriorating. Almost half often or always experience feelings of burnout and would not recommend medicine to their children. And 83% have thought of quitting medicine. What's more, today's doctors are working more but earning less in inflation-adjusted dollars. The average physician earns the same wages as they did in 1970 in inflation-adjusted dollars, but they're seeing twice the number of patients. There are fewer and fewer physicians in private practice. It's down now to 35% in 2014 from 62% in 2008. So that's a pretty short period of time. That's 6 years. And it's a really big reduction. And the consequences of that are that when a clinician is in a hospital environment or a large healthcare environment, they have less autonomy, they have more bureaucracy, and a lot more oversight and a lot less freedom to care for patients in the way that they would want to do it. So that is a profound shift that's happened just in the past 6 years. But the worst part, according to many of the doctors and other healthcare providers that I train in my programs, is the loss of a sense of meaning and purpose in their work. The vast majority of doctors that I know went into medicine to help people and to really make a difference in their lives. And that sense of reward comes from having that feeling at the end of the day that they really did make an impact in the patients' lives that they saw. And this is frankly becoming less and less common in today's healthcare environment. And I hear it every day from the doctors that we work with. Now, of course, the effects of chronic disease go far beyond individual patients and providers. There's also a cost to society as a whole. For example, the cost of treating just one condition, type 2 diabetes, is estimated to be $250 billion a year. Now, again, to put that in perspective, the UN has estimated that the cost of ending world hunger would be just $200 billion, less than we spend treating a completely preventable disease every year in the United States. Our annual healthcare expenditures are expected to hit almost $4 trillion this year. That's about 25% or one quarter of our gross domestic product, or $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in the US today. If healthcare spending continues to increase at the pace that it has been increasing at for the past several years, some estimates suggest that the U.S. will be financially insolvent or bankrupt by the year 2035. In other words, healthcare expenditures will consume our entire budget and there will be nothing left over for transportation or education or anything else. Now, with this expenditure, you would hope that we would have incredible healthcare. We should be preventing and reversing disease. We should be doing minimal harm. But unfortunately, statistics show just the opposite. A 2014 Commonwealth report ranked the U.S. last of 11 industrialized countries in measures of performance, including efficacy, safety, infant mortality, and life expectancy. Two different studies separated by 16 years, one in JAMA in 2000 and another in BMJ, both very prominent, respected journals, found that medical care is actually the third leading cause of death in the United States. And they speculated that since only 5 to 20% of iatrogenic events or events that are caused by medical intervention are reported, that if those events were reported, medical care would actually be the first leading cause of death. Each year, medical errors are responsible for 200,000 extra deaths, $77 billion in extra costs, 8 million extra hospitalizations, and 77 million extra drug prescriptions. Okay, so this is getting a little jumpy again. So we've established that chronic disease is the biggest challenge we face. Conventional medicine has failed to address it and can't in its current form, and that the consequences are profound for patients, providers, and for society at large. So what is the solution? Well, to use an analogy, the disease that our healthcare system is suffering from is multifactorial. So this means intervention has to happen on multiple fronts. We have to realign incentives. We have to address medical education and the conflicts of interest that exist there. We have to change payment models. We have to look at conflicts of interest in medical research. Two-thirds of medical research is sponsored by pharmaceutical companies right now. We have to change the medical paradigm, as we've been talking about, and change the way that healthcare is delivered so that it supports the most important interventions, as we discussed. And again, we have to address conflicts of interest, which are really deeply entrenched in our system today. Now, I don't claim to have all of the answers for these very complex problems, but I would like to propose a model that I think could be at least part of the solution, which I call the ADAPT framework. And it has three elements. Number one is the ancestral diet and lifestyle. Number two is functional medicine, and number three is a collaborative practice model. So let's talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. So the first component is what I refer to as the ancestral diet and lifestyle. We could also call it a species appropriate or genetically aligned diet and lifestyle. They're all pointing at the same thing. So earlier in the presentation, I argued that there's a profound mismatch between our genes and our biology on the one hand and our modern environment on the other, and that this mismatch is driving the chronic disease epidemic. So it follows then that reversing this mismatch and realigning our genes and our biology, or our environment rather, with our genes and our biology is the starting place for reclaiming our health. So this is a basic concept in evolutionary biology, and it's not really controversial. There's tons of observational and clinical research to support it. We talked about the Samane earlier, who have very little access to modern medical care. They also have quite high rates of infection because they live in the Amazon River Basin, so they have high rates of parasites, as you would expect. And yet, despite that, they're far healthier than us by almost every measure that you look at. They have lower blood pressure, lower blood sugar, lower risk of cardiovascular disease. They have very low rates of dementia and Alzheimer's. Now, certainly their diet plays a major role. So again, they eat all whole foods, nutrient-dense, anti-inflammatory foods, meat and fish, wild fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and starches. And if you contrast that with our diet today, the top six sources of calories in the American diet are grain-based desserts, bread, sugar-sweetened beverages, pizza, alcohol, and chicken dishes, which are primarily fried chicken dishes. This is true. These are the six top sources of calories in the American diet today. Now, of course, where the traditional diet is nutrient-dense and anti-inflammatory and low in calories, this diet is nutrient poor, high in calories, and pro-inflammatory. It's basically the mirror image of our traditional diet. But the difference goes far beyond diet. I mentioned that the Samane walk an average of 17,000 steps a day, or 8 miles a day. And that's punctuated by brief periods of more intense physical activity, sprinting if they're hunting or lifting and you know, heavy stuff and carrying it. This was the norm for human beings for the vast majority of our evolutionary history, and it still is in parts of the developing world. Contrast that with today, when the average American walks only 5,000 to 6,000 steps a day and sits for 60% of his or her day, which is an average of 6 hours. And keep in mind, that's an average. So, of course, we know then that many people are sitting for more like 10, 12, or even 14 hours a day, sitting in the car on the way to work, sitting at work all day, sitting in the car on the way home, sitting at dinner, and then sitting on the couch watching Netflix before going to bed. And that's actually a very common lifestyle in the United States today.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Sleep is another major difference. Like most hunter-gatherers, the Samane sleep for an average of 7 to 8 hours a night. And in fact, the researchers had trouble talking to them about insomnia because they don't have a word for it in their language. It took them a long time to even establish what they were trying to ask them. Contrast that with today in the U.S., when a third of Americans now get fewer than 6 hours of sleep a night, and that's up from just 2% getting fewer than 6 hours in 1950. So another profound change in a little over half a century. This is a huge problem because we now know that sleep deprivation is a major contributor to chronic disease. And this is especially true for cardiovascular and metabolic problems. For example, it's been shown that a single night of sleep deprivation can cause insulin resistance, even in healthy subjects with no pre-existing metabolic disease. Another study found that severely restricting sleep for 8 nights increased calorie intake by almost 600 calories a day. So that is equivalent to gaining a pound of weight a week or 52 pounds a year. Now, granted, that was very severe sleep deprivation in that study, but you can imagine that less severe sleep deprivation would cause still a pretty profound impact in weight gain over the course of someone's lifetime. We also now know that exposure to artificial light at night, the screens like iPads, tablets, computer screens, and even televisions, which is rare in hunter-gatherer societies and common in the developed world, profoundly impacts our circadian rhythm, which in turn impacts virtually every cell and tissue in the body, including our brainwave patterns, our hormone production, cell regulation, immune function, metabolism. And recent studies have shown that our circadian clock, what is affected by this exposure to artificial light, regulates between 10 and 15% of our gene expression. And genes control everything. Every protein in your body was created by a gene. So if something is controlling 10 to 15% of gene expression, that's a pretty big deal. So this explains why shift work, long distance travel across time zones, and abnormal light exposure is associated with everything from depression to obesity to cardiovascular disease to cancer. So there are, of course, many other differences between how groups like the Samane and we live in the industrialized world, and these include stress levels, social structure, time for leisure and play. But the key takeaway here is that when we live in alignment with what our genes and our biology are adapted for, we're naturally healthy and vital and free of chronic disease. And this is especially true if we have the added benefit of emergency medical care and the fantastic things that allopathic conventional medicine does have to offer in terms of addressing acute problems. So, you know, putting these two together is the best of both worlds, and we have the potential of living longer lifespans than any human beings have ever lived when we do that. Now, I'm not suggesting we recreate a Paleolithic lifestyle. You don't have to wear a loincloth and sleep out in the backyard, unless you want to. And there's actually some research that suggests that camping is the best way of restoring your circadian rhythm. But I'm talking about bringing our modern habits into closer alignment with, our, again, what we know is best for our genes and our biology. So two examples of this could be there are glasses now that you can buy on Amazon and other places that filter out the blue light that is emitted from the screens at night. And so when you wear them, you mitigate the harmful impact that that blue light would have. Apple now has features built into both the Mac operating system and iOS. I think it's called Night Shift in iOS, and maybe it's also called that on the Mac, I'm not sure. But if you turn it on, it naturally reduces the amount of blue light that is emitted at night based on the sun, when the sun is setting and when the sun is rising. So there's a lot of awareness about this now, and technology companies are starting to integrate those into their operating systems. So little, one of my mentors in medicine used to say that when you have a big problem, there's a tendency to believe that we need a big solution to fix it. But in reality, it's usually a series of small changes or small solution that makes the biggest difference. So, you know, things like this might not seem like they're that big of a deal or could make that much of a big impact, but collectively they add up to produce a really big effect. So the next component of the ADAPT framework is functional medicine. How many people here have heard of functional medicine? Just a quick show of hands. Okay, most people. So I won't spend too much time on this. But for those that are new to it, the easiest way to explain it is to contrast it with conventional medicine, which we're all familiar with. So in functional medicine is investigative. It treats the symptoms by addressing the root cause of the problem. And this leads to more profound and longer lasting results. Whereas in conventional medicine, they tend to mask or suppress symptoms without addressing the underlying cause. So if we go back to the blood pressure and cholesterol examples in conventional and functional medicine, we would investigate why they're high in the first place, address those things in order to lower the blood pressure and the cholesterol. In conventional medicine, as we all know, the treatment is to prescribe a drug to lower those markers. Functional medicine is holistic. It treats the body as an interconnected whole. And we recognize that in order to treat one part of the body, you have to address the entire body. Whereas conventional medicine flows out of a more dualistic or Cartesian paradigm that sees the body as a collection of separate parts. And again, there's actually a doctor for every different part of the body. And there's often little communication between these doctors who are treating the different parts of the body, or even an acknowledgement that there might be a connection. Functional medicine is typically safer. The treatments tend to have fewer side effects and risks because we're focusing on diet, lifestyle, supplements, and herbs. And unrelated complaints will often improve spontaneously. So oftentimes the side effects are positive. So for example, if we treat SIBO in a patient, their skin problem might get better. So it's kind of the opposite of what tends to happen in conventional medicine, where you take a drug for one problem and it causes four other problems. Conventional medicine tends to be more dangerous because it relies on drugs and surgery, both of which can have serious side effects and complications all the way up to death. And that is, again, evidenced by the studies that have shown that medical care is either the third or the first leading cause of death in this country. Functional medicine tends to be more patient-centered. So we treat the patient and not the disease. And this means that two patients with the same condition might actually get a different treatment based on what's happening with each person. Whereas in conventional medicine, it tends to be more disease-centered. So two people with the same disease will get the same treatment despite their individual differences. In functional medicine, ideally the patient is respected, empowered, and encouraged to play an active role in their healing process, because we know that diet, lifestyle, and behavior change are often going to be the primary drivers that determine, you know, how they'll do with the treatment process. In conventional medicine, of course, this is a generalization, but often the patient's opinion is discounted or ignored. Little time is spent on education, and the patient can sometimes actively discourage to play an active role in their healing process. How many have been to the doctor to ask a question or share something, you know, that you did your own research on, only to receive a roll of the eyes or, you know, be chided for doing that? Certainly not all doctors do this. I know many doctors who are excited to learn from their patients, but there is a little bit of this authority complex in conventional medicine where it's assumed that the doctor has the answers and the patient's job is to just receive the answers and, you know, act on them. And that, again, is less of a problem with individual doctors and more of a systemic issue in terms of how doctors are trained to interact with patients. Functional medicine is more integrative. It combines the best of allopathic and alternative approaches. It doesn't exclude drugs or surgery when they're necessary, but the focus is usually on diet, lifestyle, and behavior modification, whereas conventional medicine tends to be more limited to drugs and surgery, despite their known risks and complications. Finally, functional medicine is more preventative, has greater focus on prevention. It's guided by the ancient Chinese proverb, "The superb physician treats disease before it occurs." Whereas conventional medicine tends to be more reactive, it manages disease after it occurs, and in some cases doesn't intervene until the disease has progressed beyond the point of no return. Okay, the final component of... All right. Final component of the ADAPT framework is a collaborative practice model. Now, it's not just our medical paradigm that's poorly equipped to treat chronic disease. As I've argued, it's the model for how we deliver care isn't set up to support the changes that we need. So as we embrace this new functional medicine paradigm of care, which is starting to happen, we need to change the delivery model for that care so that it aligns better with our needs. Now, this new model, this collaborative practice model, has a few differences versus what we're doing now. So the first and most obvious, of course, is longer visits with patients. So infrequent, 10 to 12 minute visits with the doctor is just not going to cut it. They can't address the underlying causes of problems in that much time. And when we're focusing on diet and lifestyle and behavior change and also functional medicine, which is, includes some very in-depth testing and treatment protocols, you really can't do that in a 10 to 12 minute appointment. So we need longer appointments, more detailed intake and health history, and more time for discussion and support between the patient and the doctor. But the doctor can't do this on their own. We already have a shortage of primary care providers, and that shortage is expected to increase to 52,000 doctors by the year 2025. So that's a big problem. So we need to embrace this more collaborative model of care, the idea of a care team. So as right now, the doctor is the focus of the healthcare system. And we still need doctors, and we need them more than ever, but If the biggest thing that's needed is diet, lifestyle, and behavior change, doctors aren't necessarily the best people to implement that. Number one, they're not trained extensively in how to do that in medical school. Number two, we need them to stay to be available to do the doctory kind of things, right? The lab tests and treatment protocols, procedures, etc. And it takes too long, and it's way too expensive to train doctors to, you know, support people in diet and lifestyle and behavior change. So what do we do instead? Well, we can have nutritionists and health coaches that are part of a practice. These are professionals that are trained to support people in making these changes. They're trained in a variety of modalities that are evidence-based and very effective. We can have nurse practitioners and physician assistants and psychotherapists and a whole care team that really can support patients in making the changes that will make the biggest differences. I believe that health coaches are going to play an especially important role in this future of medicine. We've established that most chronic diseases are driven by diet, lifestyle, and behavior problems. So it follows that helping patients to change these behaviors is the biggest impact that we can have. So how can we do this? Tends to get stuck and then want to skip slides. So let's see here. So we established before that just giving patients information is not enough. And this is supported by countless studies and also all of our collective experience and common sense. Less than 10% of people sustain their New Year's resolutions that they make in the beginning of the year. I'm sure we've all had that experience ourselves. As I mentioned, only 6% of Americans engage in the top 5 health behaviors. And these are not fancy health behaviors. This is like not smoking, not drinking excessively, maintaining a healthy body weight, getting enough sleep, and getting some physical activity. Less 6% of Americans maintain all 5 of those health behaviors. And again, it's not because people don't know that they should be doing those things. Everybody knows that they should be doing those things. It's because behavior change is hard. It is really hard to change behavior because we're fighting against some hardwired biological mechanisms in the brain that make it difficult. So just one example is human beings are programmed to seek out highly rewarding calorie-dense food. Why? Because in a natural environment where that was characterized by food scarcity, which our environment was for the vast majority of our history, the humans that were most successful at seeking out that calorie-dense food, well, they're our ancestors. They're the ones that survived and passed their genes down. That's great in that environment, but in a modern environment with 7-Eleven on every corner and Costco, how do you think that programming works? We're fighting this default programming. It's not a individual problem of willpower. It's overcoming these hardwired mechanisms, and that's what makes behavior change so hard. And I think when we realize that and really appreciate that, that's the beginning of a successful change. But we have to come to terms with what we're up against. And that's, again, where health coaches can make a big difference because the health coach, like as I mentioned, the doctor is not the right person to have these kinds of conversations. They don't have the time. They don't have the training. We don't have enough of them. But a health coach can step in and make a big impact on supporting these healthy habits and behaviors. They have training and disciplines that support people in making lasting change. So positive psychology, which leverages people's strengths instead of fixing what's broken. Motivational interviewing, which is a methodology that helps people to discover their own motivation and strategies for change, which is far more successful for making those changes lasting instead of just telling someone what to do and why they should want to do it. Habit formation and reversal. There's so much research out there that supports how to reverse bad habits and how to create healthy habits. And health coaches are trained in that. Health coaches are also trained to work in a more collaborative way rather than the expert approach that's more common in medicine. So we call this the coach approach. And the expert approach, the practitioner acts as the authority. They assess the problem and they deliver the advice or the solution. Now that can work really well in a very acute situation, like someone's just recently been diagnosed with terminal cancer and they see an oncologist and a specialist and here's the prescription. But it doesn't work well for changes that need to occur over a long period of time, diet, lifestyle, and behavior changes. The coach approach or the collaborative approach is much more effective in that situation. So that's where the coach works as a partner or an ally. They, again, encourage the client to discover their own solutions and become their own advocate and develop lifelong skills that will empower the client, not the practitioner, to be the primary driver of change. So we've all heard the saying, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach him to fish, he eats for a lifetime. So you can think of it that way. The coaches are teaching us to fish rather than just giving us the fish. Now, this is a big movement in medicine now, not just in functional medicine, also in conventional medicine. Institutions like Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Iora Health have integrated health coaches into their care model. Corporations are increasingly utilizing health coaches. About half of all employers now with more than 50 employees have created workspace wellness programs, many of which use health coaches. Even conventional medicine organizations like the Centers for Disease Control and the National Board of Medical Examiners have recognized the need for health coaching. So we're going to see a lot deeper integration of health coaches into both the conventional and functional and integrative medicine frameworks in the next 10 years. And that's a change that really can't happen soon enough. So the third difference in the collaborative practice model is that it's both high tech and high touch. So it utilizes the latest technology to automate repetitive tasks that don't benefit from human interaction, in order to free up more time for patient contact and other services that do. So examples of this would be online scheduling and billing, an electronic health record that's optimized for functional medicine, patient handouts and guides, online classes, etc. And then finally, this new model embraces more of a micro practice model where I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but there's just less overhead and more efficiencies and more focus on patient interaction and spending quality time with the patient with the entire care team. Also, we're seeing developments in telemedicine now that's going to make care a lot more flexible. So you'd be able to have a video visit with your doctor if you're on vacation or you're somewhere else, and that's going to make it easier for providers to offer this kind of care. So the writing's on the wall. Chronic disease is shortening our lifespan. It is destroying the quality of life. It's driving clinicians out of medicine, and it's threatening to bankrupt our country. Our current medical paradigm and model of care is not set up to address the challenge of chronic disease. But the good news is that the transition to this ADAPT framework and this new model that I've described in this presentation is already underway. So there are lots of exciting examples, but I'm just going to briefly mention two. A couple years ago, the Cleveland Clinic opened a Center for Functional Medicine, spearheaded by Dr. Mark Hyman, who is one of the pioneers of functional medicine. And they started out in a pretty small space in the Cleveland Clinic, and within a few months, they had completely outgrown it. They built a 17,000 square foot in the Glickman Tower at the Cleveland Clinic, which houses their cardiology unit and hepatology, which are the top units in those specialties in the world. They were up to 16 clinicians last year. I don't have the most recent numbers. And had over 50 employees, had 3,000 patients from 9 countries around the world on the wait list, and 25% of them were new to the Cleveland Clinic, which meant that they were driving demand at the Cleveland Clinic. So incredible success story. I talk to Mark Hyman maybe once a month, and he's, you know, I can hardly keep up with everything that's going on there. They're doing research, clinical trials, and population-based studies. It's really incredible. Another example is a little different, and this is Iora Health. It's a primary care group in the Rocky Mountain area that's using health coaches to reverse type 2 diabetes. So their model is that the patients still see the doctor, but only once or twice a year, and their primary interaction is with the health coach. And these are generally people from areas of lower socioeconomic status, and so the coaches will go into their homes, they'll help do a pantry clean out, they'll take them shopping to the store and teach them what foods to eat, they'll provide them with meal plans and, you know, shopping or recipe tips, and they'll really kind of hold their hand through the whole process and work with them until they get on board. And it's tremendously popular. The Net Promoter Score, which is a assessment tool that's used to determine how likely it is that someone will recommend a business to a friend or a family member, is 92. Now, put that in perspective, the Net Promoter Score for Apple, which is, you know, has a crazy fan base, is in the 70s, the low 70s, and the highest healthcare provider, Kaiser, is 36, I believe. Okay, so if you're intrigued and would like to learn more, my book, Unconventional Medicine, goes into these topics in a lot more detail, and I think they have some copies out there, and I'll be signing copies after the talk. My website, chriscresser.com, lots of free stuff there. If you're interested in training, I have training programs for doctors and licensed clinicians in functional medicine, and also a training program for health coaches. I think there are a few in the training programs here. Raise hands. Great. And then we have, so that's cresserinstitute.com to learn more about the training. And then we have a monthly membership platform where you can kind of dip your toe in the water and learn some of these concepts, you know, without committing to a full year-long training program. And that's called the Adapt Academy. And you can also learn about that at cresserinstitute.com. Thank you so much for being here and for your attention.
About 10 questions. Great. In 15 minutes.
Sorry. Okay, sounds good. All right, so we've got some questions here. Just going to get a quick drink of water. All right, for a practitioner working in conventional medicine but training in functional medicine, yeah, adapt. All right, I like that question. What are your top 5 recommendations to start to move the system from the inside out toward a new paradigm? Specifically, labs, lifestyle recommendations, data to share with colleagues if they want to read your book. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the change actually is happening from the inside out. So where I see the biggest shift is when a patient comes in to the doctor and tells them about, you know, a transformation that they've had, and the doctor gets curious and then starts to look into it themselves. And we've actually had a lot of doctors come into the training program that way. So it's kind of like a grassroots change that's happening. I think doctors within conventional medicine getting training in functional medicine, sharing that training with your colleagues, sharing results that you're getting, using even small amounts of that in your practice is really important. You know, sharing books and resources that you found to be helpful or that, you know, that you've been exposed to that have made a big difference for you. All of this can make a really big difference, at least, you know, from the inside out. And you know, I did a workshop at 1440, which is a retreat center in Santa Cruz Mountains, on burnout for healthcare providers a couple weekends ago. There were a lot of doctors there from the Bay Area, Sutter Health. And I can tell you, everyone is thinking about this and talking about this. Like, this is really on the top of people's minds. We're working now with, been contacted by a number of organizations, you know, corporations, churches, We did a pilot program with the Berkeley Fire Department recently, and we're doing another one with them and also with the Santa Clara Fire Department. So I think it's happening. We just have to be patient. It's hard when you're in that situation and you want to make the change. But, you know, just continuing to share your enthusiasm with your colleagues and share resources that have been helpful, I think, is the best change you can make internally. Okay. What do you think about the supplement industry in the USA and many people with shopping bags full of supplements, taking them daily, uncontrollable and without deep understanding of underlying biochemistry? Yeah, good question. It's problematic for sure. And I'm sure some of you saw the recent study that came out showing that a lot, you know, something like 46% of the supplements they studied had drugs or, you know, drug compounds in them and other ingredients that were not on the label. Now, granted, a lot of those were like bodybuilding supplements and sexual enhancement supplements and kind of what I would call the bottom of the barrel supplements. So, you know, the lesson is don't go into GNC and buy like, you know, muscle pump powder or something and try to get supplements from companies like Thorne or, you know, that sell to professionals that have a good reputation, pure encapsulations. They do third party auditing. You can ask for their audits. They have, you know, they should have certificates that are available on their websites that actually show, you know, their audits and the results of the audits. And that's what I do as a practitioner. But yeah, I agree. It's really problematic because there are lots of things that you can buy that actually can harm you if you don't know what you're doing. And I see a lot of patients that are doing that unwittingly. I think it's a consequence of the issues that we talked about tonight, because people are forced to go out and try to help themselves because they're not getting the help that they need from the healthcare system. So I think the more we can provide the right kind of care through a care team in the collaborative model that I mentioned, I think the less people will have to self-treat. So that's how I think we can solve the problem. Okay, next question. As an herbalist, a major topic of discussion between fellow herbalists and unconventional medicine practitioners is how can we promote more research in these fields? Yeah, that is a big challenge because, as I mentioned, 2/3 of medical research is sponsored by Big Pharma. And there's a lot of research that we need done, for example, on nutrition. I'm very interested, for example, in the question of what is the effect of saturated fat in the context of a healthy diet. So if you take people, two groups who are eating, you know, all, you know, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, all the kind of diet that we talked about, and one group has higher saturated fat intake and the other group has lower, what happens to those people, you know, over 20 years? We're never going to see that study unless we really, the science environment changes a lot, because there's no financial incentive for any drug company to sponsor that study. And public health funding for research is so dismal and getting worse all the time that no one's going to pay for that study. So there's a lot of important research that's not being done on herbs and botanicals to, you know, companies that sell botanicals don't have the big pockets that pharmaceutical companies have. So they can't pay, you know, tens of millions of dollars for a double blind RCT that lasts for a year or 2 years. So, I don't, you know, unfortunately, I don't have an easy answer to that question, because that's something that's outside of all of our control as individuals. But that's exactly what Mark Hyman and his team at the Cleveland Clinic are doing. They're starting to study functional medicine. They're starting to change the research paradigm. And so instead of just myopically focusing on randomized controlled trials, which just isolate one intervention, they're looking at how they're comparing functional medicine with standard care, which I think is the right way to go about it. So they're taking a group of patients with diabetes. They're saying, you go do the standard care, you take metformin and the drugs. We'll do our thing with functional medicine. Let's compare and see what happens. And I think that's the best way to study these kinds of interventions. We have to get out of this reductionist model where we think it all comes down to like isolated ingredients, because that's not how the body works. Okay, the vast majority of patients know of lifestyle choices and I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time reading the writing. If you can help me out, if this is yours, and their effects on health. What else can the health practitioners do to convince patients to adhere to healthy choices? So this is a problem with the model itself. I think it's not the fault of healthcare practitioners. In a 10 to 12 minute interaction, you're not going to be able to convince anyone of anything unless you're like a magician. And if you know how to do that, talk to me after the after this presentation, because I'd like to know your tricks. How many of you have had a lot of success convincing other people to do things in here? Doesn't work, right? So this is why health coaching is so important, because it's not a health coach. Their job is not to convince people to do anything. Their job is to be an ally and a guide and help people to discover their own motivation for change. That's what I mentioned. How do you do that? You do it by asking questions. That's the primary method of intervention of a health coach, is to ask good questions. And through these questions, you can learn how to help someone resolve ambivalence. Ambivalence is defined as, in this context, as having equal reasons for changing and not changing. So when people don't change, it's not because they're lazy or just strong-willed or weak-willed or, there's something wrong with them. They don't change because they have good reasons for not changing. And we have to help people to become aware of what those good reasons are and then find alternative ways of meeting those needs that are healthier and better for their well-being. And that's, again, what a health coach is skilled at doing. But you can't do that in a 10-minute appointment. And this is where practitioners feel like they're beating their heads against the wall. They think, you know, I'm telling the patients to change their diet and they're not changing. What's wrong with these patients? Or what's wrong with me that I'm not doing it right? You know, I had someone come up to me at a conference I spoke at, and they said, you know, they were just feeling really frustrated and they were thinking of getting out of this field. And I asked what was going on. And they said, I want your patients because they clearly listen to you. And I said, no, that's not exactly how it works. We have to change the model because we're dealing with very hardwired human tendencies. We do not like to be told what to do. Anybody have kids? Yeah, that's, you know, it's a powerful reflection when you see like, oh, okay, this is how it works. Evolutionary consumption of insects is a source of omega-3s, and humans' lack of ability to synthesize omega-3s. Please comment. I think insect protein, while not appealing and on the surface, is actually has a lot to be said for it. You know, it's environmentally more sustainable, and it's a very high quality protein source from an amino acid profile. They can be a source of healthy fats. So I'm all for it. I think it's going to be an uphill battle for a little while. But how many have had an EXO bar, the cricket protein bars? Yeah. My first time having one of those, I was at the party before they launched it, and no one told us anything about what was happening. And we were sitting around, and there was like someone came around with an hors d'oeuvre tray and had their little toothpicks and these little bar things. And, you know, we're like, oh, that looks good. We'll try that. And then they're like, oh, you're all eating cricket protein. And everyone's like, well, what? You know, it was really funny. No, but you can't taste, it's odorless and tasteless. So once you get over the cognitive dissonance, it's actually quite good. Second question is a big one. Why can't we get insurance companies to cover functional medicine treatment? It's not how the model is set up right now. I talked about the need to realign incentives. Right now, the doctors and healthcare providers are not incentivized to get results. They get paid regardless of the result. And they get paid in many cases to order procedures, which aren't necessarily benefiting the patient at all. But this is already starting to shift. How many have heard of capitated payments? Kind of a technical term. So like Iora Health uses capitated payments. So what this means is that they go to the insurance company and they say, give us your patients with type 2 diabetes. We will take them back to pre-diabetes or even non-diabetic. If we do that, you pay us X. If we exceed that goal, you pay us Y. And if we don't reach that goal, you pay us less. So that's the way where everyone's nodding their head. Oh, that makes sense, right? That's kind of how it works in almost every other field except for medicine. You actually get rewarded for good performance. And now the biggest payers like Medicare, they're now shifting that burden to providers. And providers are going to have to get results. And now once that responsibility is on the shoulders of these big provider groups, they're now starting to look at other models of care that are going to get better results. And I think when that happens, you will actually start to see more coverage for functional medicine type of treatment because the incentives will be more aligned. Everybody knows that the model we have now is not sustainable. That is not controversial. I mean, you could go into any conventional medicine organization. I've had conversations with people at high levels in insurance companies and payer organizations, in the government. Everybody knows that's a problem. There's, of course, some argument about what to do about it, but there's no question of the problem. Okay. I went the wrong way, right? So you described the general problems with the current medical system, so please elaborate on what individuals can do beyond generic advice about diet, lifestyle, and behavior. In other words, what are the top things we can do to improve our health? Well, that's a different talk. But yeah, I mean, basically, I would say the four biggest levers probably, although I think it will depend from person to person, is nutrient-dense, anti-inflammatory whole foods diet. So if you want to boil that down to three words, it would be just eat real food. I mean, seriously, like if people did that, that's 80% of the battle right there. If we just ate real food, like forget about arguing about vegetarian, vegan, paleo, all this stuff. Just eating real food, like stuff that's not highly processed and refined, would solve a lot of problems. 60% of calories for Americans now come from ultra-processed food. Not just processed food, but ultra-processed food. So yeah, that's the big starting place. Getting 7-8 hours of sleep a night. Getting adequate amounts of physical activity and not sitting too much. Those are different things. There's actually been studies that have shown that people training for a marathon were still at much higher risk of disease and early death if they spent the rest of their time sitting. So it's very important to stand, walk, move, take breaks. If you're sitting, you have a type of job where you sit in front of a computer. You can get apps now like Time Out on the Mac or Workrave on the PC that remind you to take a break every 45 minutes. Even standing up for 2 minutes has been shown to mitigate the harmful impacts. 2 minutes every 45 or 60 minutes has been shown to mitigate a lot of the harms of sitting. And then managing stress. That's easier said than done. I didn't say reducing or eliminating stress, which is impossible and not even desirable, but managing stress, just doing some simple things like mindfulness practice, deep breathing, meditation, biofeedback, neurofeedback those are like the four pillars, I think, that everybody should get dialed in as much as possible. And then there's also things like social support, spending time outdoors, play, and pleasure, having a good time. Those have all been shown to be very important for health. I think I'm about to get the hook. So thank you very much again for all of your questions, for being here.
Hello, is this on? Hello, okay. I'm Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank Chris Kresser for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.